Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers, with Frank Thompson.
Hello again, welcome back to episode 3 of the Commentary Track. My name is Frank Thompson. Feels really good to be able to say that after all these years. As I'm sure most of you know, since 1946, I've had to go under a pseudonym. But now that the blacklist is over, I can go by the very name that my family gave me and be proud of it. So thank you, Kirk. I appreciate it. We have a great show coming up tonight, I believe. I say tonight because it's night when I'm recording this. I have no idea when you're going to be listening to it. That's the wonderful thing about this whole podcast world, isn't it? Paul F. Tompkins says it's nighttime on the internet. I believe that it's all times everywhere on the internet. So good morning and day and evening and night and early morning to you. And whatever time it is, happy then. First, I need to do a little housekeeping, as it were. Invite you all to go to my website, thecommentarytrack.com. Now, be sure to type in thecommentarytrack.com, or else it'll lead you to another website that has nothing whatsoever to do with me. As a matter of fact, when I see that other commentarytrack.com on the street, we neither nod nor speak. Not that I have anything against them. They're all well and good in their way, but they're just not our kind of people, if you know what I mean. The Commentary Track is what you want to listen to. That's my website for my podcast and for all things me and my guests. There are pages on the website that you will see right away, one called Books, one called Videos. The Books one will lead you to my own books that I wrote, and you'll have two ways of buying them. Some of them I have copies of, and you can hit the buy button. You'll get a PayPal link, and then you can send me a note from that PayPal link telling me if you'd like me to autograph the book, and I'd be more than happy to do that, if it's even possible to be more than happy. And if I don't have extra copies of these books, I've provided Amazon links, and so you can click right over to Amazon and buy them there. Now, that will help me in not the way you would think, because most of these books I don't get any royalties from, so if you get it through Amazon, it's not going to help me particularly in that way. However, because I'm an Amazon associate, if you click through my website, Amazon will give me a little bit of a kickback on whatever you spend. And I must always reassure you, it does not cost you one extra penny to order this way. There's no premium for ordering through my website. You're going to pay exactly what you're going to pay. But whatever that is, Amazon's going to give me a few pennies. And those pennies add up, I hope. And little by little, we'll have enough to keep this thing going. This website is free. The podcast is free to you, but it cost me money to put it on. So any little thing that you can do along those lines would be much appreciated. I even have, and I know this is a long shot, but I even have a PayPal link right on the homepage that you can click and just make a donation just to help keep things going. Now, I realize the chances are slim that anybody will ever do this, but the option is there, and what do I know? Some wonderful saint might come along, some beautiful, pure soul who just wants to give, and I want to take. So thank you so much. The most recent book I added to my list, a book that I have extra copies of, is one called The Alamo Cultural History. And it's always been a favorite of mine in many ways. I've written 5 books related to the Alamo, possibly as many as anybody needs to write on any given subject. But this one is kind of special because it's not necessarily the book that you would turn to if you want all the facts and figures about the Battle of the Alamo in 1836. What it is about the cultural impact that battle had on the ensuing 170-odd years. So there are chapters on Alamo movies, on Alamo plays, poems, literature, Alamo toys. even Alamo ghost stories. I even tell the story of Ozzy Osbourne and how he was arrested for peeing on the Alamo. And I must make clear, he did not actually pee on the Alamo. He peed on the Alamo Cenotaph, the monument that sits across the street from it in Alamo Plaza. Still, if you're a stickler about having the Alamo peed on, the Cenotaph is close enough. So I'm not condoning what Ozzy did. I'm just trying to give you the facts as straight as I know them. So I think that's a fun book. A lot of color pictures and written in a nice breezy style that's so unlike me in so many ways. But that's just one of the books. And there are also my Star Film Ranch book, my book Texas Hollywood on the History of Filmmaking in San Antonio, speaking of the Alamo, and others. I do have several of my books there, and then many, many, many more books. Now, I also put a page of books and videos for each of my guests. Last week, Thomas W. Holland. There are several of the books that he published, and also links to a couple of the films that we talked about during our discussion last week. This week will be the same with this week's guest, and you'll find links to his books, to movies on which he's done commentary tracks, and he's done many. And as a matter of fact, as a way of introducing Mr. Rudy Belmer, who is my guest, I'll say that a couple of years ago that he and I and John Burlingame, who is the master historian of all things film music related, did a commentary track, the three of us, for Raoul Walsh's Objective Burma. And I have to say that with an exclamation point because it's in the title, Objective Burma, with Errol Flynn. And that was a really great experience for me because these are two incredibly knowledgeable guys. I was definitely outclassed in that room. And I was also feeling sicker than anybody else in the room. Throughout the entire thing, I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker with some sort of flu-like symptoms. And my main memory of that is every once in a while stopping and saying, I have to go get something to drink. Or I have to go to the bathroom. But nonetheless, it was a wonderful experience. And wonderful because I finally got to work with the great Rudy Belmer. I have admired him for a long, 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 long time. I think I first found his book, Memo from David O. Selznick, probably 25 years, maybe longer ago. Was completely captivated by it. And then his book Inside Warner Brothers was also just one of those great books that dealt with memos, daily production reports, things that were being written during the production of a lot of important Warner Brothers films. Warner Brothers is very close to Rudy's heart, and you haven't lived until you've heard his commentary tracks on, say, The Adventures of Robin Hood, which I don't know that I would classify it as his favorite film because I don't think he's ever said that to me, but I know he loves, loves, loves it and has a lot to say about it. And also he did a commentary track on Gone with the Wind and so many films. Singing in the Rain, he's there. He really knows everything. But I think more important than that, because I know a lot of people who are pretty knowledgeable about film history, but Rudy is just a great guy and somebody that I would rather talk with Rudy than almost anybody else, especially on subject of film. We have a lot of the same enthusiasms, and more important, I think we have the same sense of humor. And I look for reasons to go over to Rudy's house. I'll sometimes think of very skimpy. You know, I'll call him up, Rudy, I have this DVD that you mentioned in passing that you would kind of like to see, and it's very important that I drop it by your house so that you can watch it. But it's mostly because I want to come in and sit down on his couch, pet his wonderful dog, and just sit there for a couple of hours just talking movies. Nothing more fun for me. And the conversation that's coming up is actually the first of two interviews that I taped with him. That happened this way. I went over because he was obviously in the first rank of people that I wanted to have on the commentary track. So I went over very early in the process. He was probably only the second or third person that I interviewed. And we had a great time and talked and talked and talked. And a couple of days later, he called me up and said, you know, I was thinking about what we were talking about, and when we talked about this, I really feel like I should have said that. And we were talking about this other subject. I really felt like I should have added this. Would you mind coming over so we could tape a couple of pickups and you could put them in? Now, of course, I was delighted to do that, not realizing fully at that moment that my amateur basis, my amateur status as an audio editor would make putting in those little pickups a living hell. But I finally did, and you'll probably notice a distinctive difference in tonal quality when those couple of little moments pop in and out of the interview that you're about to hear, because believe me, I am not good at this. I am not an audio editor, but I have tried my best to learn the program, and I'm getting better at it. So that's we did that. But in the process of doing those couple of pickups, I ended up staying there for another hour and a half, and we just kept talking about all sorts of other things. So there is at least a two-part presentation with Rudy Belmer, and this is the first one. I'll tell you, I just have not decided whether the second one is going to be next week or if I'm going to delay it for a while and just keep having a unique guest for a while before I bring somebody in for a part two. Between you and me and the gatepost, I think that's probably the way it's going to go. But you never can tell. Next week, you'll see what you will see. And in the meantime, I think you're going to hear a lot about Rudy that probably you've never heard in an interview before. Talk a lot about his own life, how he got started being interested in films, how he became interested in making films. And it's an interesting journey, and he talks about a lot of things that are just fascinating to me. And more important, he's just a great guy to talk with, and I think you'll find that he's a great guy to listen to. So here is part one of my two-part interview with the great Rudy Belmer.
Well, the first movie I remember seeing, only because it scared me, was The Phantom of Crestwood, which was an RKO, as you probably know, an RKO radio film, early 30s. And it ended with this woman killing herself, jumping off the cliff. And I don't know why, but somehow that hit me and stuck in my mind. And, of course, I saw it at the Golden Gate RKO, Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco. So it was one of those early experiences that my father took me to when I was five or somewhere in there. And it really frightened me. But I never remembered the name of the film. And then years, decades later, down at the County Art Museum, they ran this picture, The Phantom of Crestwood. And I looked, you know, at the paper and so forth. This was when Ron Haver was there. Mm-hmm. And they were doing all those screenings, you know. And I thought, anyway, I went to see it, and I thought, this is the movie! Which, of course, I hadn't thought of since the time I was there, but never knew the title. But that was certainly, if not one of the first in the first few months, you know. And then, of course, I remembered seeing the things like the Kennel murder case, because I couldn't understand how this guy who was supposedly dead walked up the stairs. And I wasn't quite sure what an internal hemorrhage, you know, and so forth and so on. And then the mystery of the Wax Museum, which scared me to death once the slap hit the face with Lionel Atwill and so forth. So you remember, obviously, those things that hit you hard. And those were early, early films that I recalled. And The Rainmaker with Wheeler Wills because of the big train thing at the end. You know, things like that.
Sure. Let me bring the conversation back to me where it belongs.
Oh, yeah.
When my wife and I were married in 1993, the only two people at our wedding were my mother and Karen Morley, star of Phantom of Crestwood.
That's right.
So there you go.
She was not the woman who jumped off the cliff.
No, she was not. That would have been perfect if she had been. No, she was not.
No, and that was, you know, at the time, that was kind of a big, like, I read about it later, needless to say, after I found out that was the movie, but here's Marion C. Cooper, you know, and they did this big exploitation of the thing. Apparently it did well, and it actually was, seeing it at the County Art Museum in the 70s or 80s, whenever it was, it was not a bad film.
No, I saw it, I saw it when I knew Karen. She has left us now to for her great reward, but it's...
Well, she hung in
it's a fun,
quite a while.
Quite a long time.
Yeah.
Interesting story.
Yeah.
You were telling me the other day about the first movie that you remember going to, but you don't remember the movie itself, but I love that story. What?
Well, my father, who loved movies, incidentally, he wasn't in a business of any kind. He was a brewer. But this is in San Francisco, and my mother and father were divorced, so he would pick me up on Sunday when I was a little kid and take me to the zoo or to the Golden Gate Park and the playgrounds and, you know, whatever we could do that was within reason in the San Francisco area. And then I saw him on Wednesday after school. But anyway, so I think it was when I just turned 5. That must have been the keynote, based upon the things that I remember from movies. And he said, okay, now today we're going to the movies. And I said, the what? Or something to this effect. And we went down to the RKO Golden Gate Theater, which was an RKO, you know, theater, Keith Orpheum. So mm-hmm. they had vaudeville still. And this would have been, again, in late 31, 32, somewhere in there. And he said, we're going, so we'll go. And we sit down. It's the first show, 11 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, it's the full production. You get the movie, you get the newsreel, you get the short, you get the transition, the curtains close, and the mighty Wurlitzer man is sitting up there doing his thing with the organ. And I'm just sitting there like this. I've seen this big screen and all these big people, which, of course, I couldn't figure out at all. And at the curtain closes, and I'm hearing this organ, which I probably had never heard before in any way, shape, or form. And then the curtains open, and of course the people are on the stage now, in regular size, and that confused me. But here's the orchestra, which at that time was in the pits. Later on they brought it up to the stage when it became fashionable to have the band on the stage, right? Particularly with the swing era approaching. Anyway, and of course I'm getting 8 acts of vaudeville, and I'm getting, you know, the Master of Ceremonies, and I'm getting the Keith Orpheum circuit, you know, from all over the country coming, and they come once a year, maybe, or something like that. But it went on every week. So I'm just sitting there, I think the spellbound in darkness. How's that? And I was just, you know, and my father said, well, how'd you, I said, oh, when it was over, and I had questions, you know, how come the big people are big, and then there's, you know, small, and the music, and, you know, the cymbals, when the people are dancing, and they hit... I hear this, and I couldn't figure that out because I couldn't see the orchestra. Anyway, so the next week, the next Sunday, I said, where are we going? And he said, well, we're going to go. I said, well, I want to go back to the Golden Gate Theater. And he said, well, it's the same show that you're holding it over for. I don't care. So that was seemed to be the plan of the many months until I started going to the Saturday matinee at the Neighborhood Theater. In the Richmond District, the Balboa Theater. And, of course, discovered the Saturday matinee with the 2 movies, the serial, and 3 cartoons, 2 of which were not very good, and 1 was always a good one. And 10 cents. So I got 10 cents and a penny for candy to go down. Since it was 2.5 blocks away, that was no problem. And then I became, you know, excited about serials.
Yeah. Do you still have any fondness for them?
Well, nostalgically. It's not like I, you know, I want to collect every serial on video or whatever. But I do remember, you know, those early serials, which, of course, were very exciting to me with the cliffhangers and going back the next week. And anyway, and I do remember Burn 'Em Up Barnes, which was a good serial at the time, and Clyde Beatty, The Lost Jungle, which... I thought was really swell, you know. And I remembered, it goes on and on and on. And, of course, later on, the first Flash Gordon, which by then, of course, I'm much older and very sophisticated. But that first Flash Gordon series, which they ran downtown on a regular, at a big Fox theater. And it was running all week. First run in 1936, if you can imagine. That's the only time that ever happened. And that really got me, because I had been a fan of the comic, Sunday comic strip, since it started the year before. Anyway, so that's my story in terms of being exposed to early movies and getting the stage show for good measure and the orchestra and what have you. And the O'Neill sisters with their ladies on the stage doing the Rockette number.
Well, that must have been memorable.
That was memorable. So the whole thing, it was like, this is it. You know, forget the ball games and all that stuff. Give me the...
We just finished watching the Flash Gordon serial. We have some friends who get together every Thursday, and we've gone through two serials in a row, Dick Tracy and then Flash Gordon.
Yeah. Now, this was the first Flash Gordon?
This is when Dale Arden is blonde.
Yes.
Gene Parker? Gene
Rogers.
Rogers.
I mean... And you know, I must say, when I saw the Flash Gordon serial in 1936, and I saw Gene Rogers, it was the first kind of vague feeling that, hey...
something new has been added.
Because she looked great, you know, and she had these kind of somewhat abbreviated costumes and all this. And up to then, you know...
Very appealing, yes.
Very appealing, and, you know, for somebody who's relatively young, you'd think, well, but you kind of got the feeling that maybe girls were okay after all, versus, you know, separate the girls from the boys at the party, what have you. Anyway.
When did it happen that you started thinking that movies were more than simply a pastime to you, and that's something that you might want to take seriously?
Well, I can't say right from the beginning, because I was just kind of amazed, you know, and drinking it all in. But time went by, and I became more and more interested in the whole thing. And watching, once I got used to the movie tech, I was watching and seeing how, you know, in my mind, how it was put together. And I guess it kind of amazed me that I could figure this out to a degree. I'm speaking of very rudimentary. And I thought, gee, this is fascinating. And I hear the music, the scoring. And I was always very much interested in music ever since I can remember. How about the prenatal state?
Well, not.
But anyway, so I was interested in listening to the music. And I was listening to this and that and checking. And it all started to congeal a little bit as time went by. And then I started getting interested in reading about it, because the neighborhood library was a block and a half away. And I'd go over there and look at different things. And, of course, the books then, I'm speaking now by mid-30s or a little later, the books then were, you know, like the A Million and One Nights by Terry Ramsey and A History of the Movies, an early 30s volume, and various things of that nature. And I became fascinated just reading about all this. And then the March of Time came out, which is the movie's march on, and it would fill the whole 20 minutes versus three subjects. And that was fascinating because it took you through the development of film and the stars and the what have you. And it was done in conjunction with the Museum of Modern Art. So that kind of got me intrigued. I mean, in terms of the historical, you know, the evolution and all of this business. So I was reading about it and then went to the San Francisco World's Fair in 1939-1940 on Treasure Island. And they had a film called Land of Liberty, which was the motion picture industry's contribution to the World's Fair, both the one here and the one concurrently in New York at that time. And it was a two-year thing. They renewed it for the second year. So here is this 2-hour and 30-minute number, which was in the Federal Building and had an auditorium, and it was free. And I'd go in there and watch this Land of Liberty, which was a compilation production of the history of the United States, drawn from all the studio's material, stock footage, and scenes from this, that, and the other thing. And, of course, Cecil B. DeMille was the so-called producer of it, but it was actually an industry thing, but he narrated it. And you had the stock music and et cetera, et cetera. Well, I just, every time I went to the fair, not when I went with my mother or father, or, you know, a group of the kids went, but sometimes I'd go by myself. You'd get in the ferry boat, go to the fair on Saturday, and, you know, it was kind of a routine thing. And I'd go to the federal building and watch Land of Liberty. So all of these things were congealing in a certain way, you know. And then I started, I got an 8mm camera and projector from my father for Christmas in 38, I believe it was. And I started shooting little films. And then I got a little editor, and I was editing. And then we were making films, you know, film productions when I was 12, 13 years old, and waiting for the film to come back, because you sent the film out. And it went, I believe it went, it didn't go in town. I think it came down here, but you were waiting for the mail every day for, you know, a week. And when it would come, I'd call my friend, you know, and say, hey, my co-producer, it was Rudon Productions, Rudy and Don.
Nice.
Okay? Come on, the film, right? So he'd come over, and we'd, you know, run it, you know, on the kitchen wall or whatever. And that was very exciting. These were little tales, you know, that ran maybe 10 minutes or so, adventure tales. And so that was kind of, that got me even going more. And anyway, you know, that's how it evolved.
In the 30s and 40s, it was probably a lot harder to see older films, right? I mean, before TV.
That was one of the things that if you didn't see it when it came out, you didn't see it. With rare exception, you know, with The Gauntlet of the Wind. But this was years later when they do that, or Snow White and stuff. But the reissues were few and far between in the 30s and early 40s. And you didn't wait for the reissue. And, of course, you would go, if there was something you really wanted to see desperately, you'd go downtown, you know, and see it at the first run theater, as they had in those days. And then it would come maybe 6 weeks later to the neighborhood houses. By then it had splices, or it had, you know, had problems, but you didn't care. You know, it was part of the experience. But you knew that you had to see it if you wanted to see it, and if you really wanted to see it, you'd keep going back and seeing it again. I remember when The Adventures of Robin Hood showed up in spring of 1938, first run, and it was at the Fox Theater, which is huge, no longer there, huge, one of those movie palaces, you know, thousands of people and so forth. And I saw it there with Judge Hardy's children, always a double bill. That was the third in the Hardy family movies. And, of course, I thought this was great, and it was Technicolor and, you know, and all that. And then it came to the neighborhoods, and I saw it. And finally I thought, well, gee, this is but, you know, I'll never see it again. That's the end of that. But they kept a print in the exchanges at that time, you know, since the studios owned a lot of their own theaters, the major studios. They kept a print at the booking place up there, Warner Brothers. And every once in a while, it would show up at a neighborhood house where I guess they, you know, they didn't have something for 2 days because they'd have multiple, you know, like 3 times a week they'd change the bill at the neighborhood house. And Robin Hood would show up. It was the same print. So I got used to the splices, the color shifts with the reel changes, and, you know, all of the things that we come to know and love if you've seen that same print over and over. And I was just amazed that that happened, you know. So anyway, that was that. But another pictures, like I remember going down to the Golden Gate and seeing Snow White and thinking this is the greatest thing since sliced bread at the time, 1937, first run. And I went back, you know, and saw it maybe 4 times. And, of course, when they had a big picture at the Golden Gate, because they still had the vaudeville, the vaudeville was like 20 minutes because they clear the house, right? And let's get back to the movie so that they could get more people in. When the picture was just average or not, the vaudeville show was longer, you know, because that they'd have some star attraction or something, mm-hmm. which they would bill as a star attraction, a comedian or whoever that had a name of sorts. So, but with Snow White and Pinocchio, and of course with, needless to say, with Astaire and Rogers, these are RKO pictures, Astaire and Roger pictures, and some of the Begunga Deans and so forth, you know, there would be the mob scene, but the vaudeville was like, hello and goodbye. And the Mighty Wurlitzer was like 3 minutes between things, you know.
Sure.
But anyway.
Yeah, I was wondering, by the time Gone with the Wind came out, which was hugely long.
Yes.
I wonder if they had vaudeville at all, or if that was just such a special thing.
Well, no, because Gone with the Wind showed up at Lowe's Warfield Theater in San Francisco, which, you know, was an MGM theater at the time. And they had an afternoon show, which you could walk into. Then they had an evening show, which was reserved seats. But they didn't have vaudeville. So when I'm speaking of vaudeville in the 30s, it was the RKO Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco.
And pretty much that was it. Yeah.
Well, a couple of places had it coming and going, and mostly going. But the RKO Golden Gate, being a Keith Orpheum circuit, they kind of kept it going until the big bands came in. And when the big bands in the late 30s, you'd have, you know, Benny Goodman and his orchestra, Tommy Dorsey, and that would be the stage show when they'd come in. So it evolved, so to speak. And, of course, it was fascinating to me because I became in love with the big bands, you know, the swing era.
Sure.
So I was going down there to see, which were on stage, you know, the bands were no longer in the pit, they were on the stage. So I'd go and see the big bands and think that was the greatest thing since last, and stay for two shows.
Mm.
And, of course, the movie was not a big deal because they'd make it one of their lesser efforts.
Sure.
So you could get back to that stage show without having to wait for 3 hours, right?
Yeah. When I think back of the era of movie going that I missed, I regret not ever seeing vaudeville or any of that. Although a lot of those acts exist on film, so we kind of kind of experience them.
That's right.
But the thing that I really regret missing is the era of the prologues. And only through Footlight Parade, is it Footlight Parade when Cagney is staging the prologue?
Yes.
That's really the only.
The
only evocation of that period. But every time I'm researching a silent picture, I just look at the prologue. I've got all these stills from the prologue when Beau Geste opened in 26 New York. And they had a big backdrop with a Ford on it, and they, you know, Legionnaires came out and sang songs, and there's all this stuff, and you think almost every major release had this big act that was connected with the movie.
Yes.
And Public Enemy had a prologue that was done with marionettes. And
did they have little Tommy guns?
I guess. I just read about it in the reviews, and of course there's no record of that stuff at all that I know of.
Well, you know,
so that's a really lost era.
Since you mentioned that, I do recall that even some of the theaters that weren't running vaudeville, they would have a special Christmas pageant, which obviously a Christmas theme, and you'd have a group of dancers and singers and what have you on the stage, and it would be keyed to this, maybe a 30-minute presentation, keyed to the holiday season, or keyed to something. But it would be a special, so it would be like a prologue. You know, and of course you had the Fanchon and Marco, what have you, and all these people who were, you know, staging, who had staged the prologues, and now we're doing these special things. So I found that to be fascinating too.
So you got a little bit of that. I think the only thing close to that I ever experienced was in the 60s when they were still doing spook shows.
Oh yeah.
And so they would come out and they would, you know, cut a body in half, and they would scare the audience in various ways, and monsters would run amok in the theater, and then they would
as
they are wont to do. What else is a monster for if not to run amok?
He has to run amok or look.
And then they'd end up, you know, show hillbillies in a haunted house or something.
Yeah,
like some god awful thing that nobody wanted to see.
Well, you know, speaking of that, and of course you're acting as a catalyst because one thing will lead to another, as it always does. I remember in, I think it was 38, when they reissued a double horror show to first run houses, Frankenstein and Dracula, which of course I had not seen as a kid. I mean, as a little kid, they were sure. My mother and father said, no. So here they were, it was down at the Orpheum Theater in San Francisco, which was on Market Street, the main street. And it was my birthday, 12th birthday, I think it was, yeah. So Saturday was, we were going to go down, I think there were three kids, I lived in an apartment house, there for cake and ice cream and something and birthday. And then my mother was going to drive us down to see Frankenstein and Dracula. And, of course, we go down there. And here's this long line. This is a first-run house, you know. They'd already tested it and found that they had a gold mine on their hand with this reissue. And so you stood in line, and we finally, after 30 minutes, we go in and sit down, and we're seeing Frankenstein and Dracula. And I'll never forget going the drive home. My mother's driving, and I'm saying, you know, it's funny that there wasn't any music. Once the main titles, you know, this is where I'm. there was no score, you know, no score. They had the main title music in the end, and this is my big revelation, you know, to everyone. I'm sure they thought, who cares, Rudy, for God, you know. And of course, the revelation that Frankenstein was much better than Dracula. And I had nothing against Dracula. In fact, later I was reading the original Bram Stoker novel and thinking it was terrific. But for the movie, other than the opening, I didn't, you know, was based more on the stage play. And sure. I had nothing the matter with it, but I thought Frankenstein as a film, and James Whale's direction. So I'm thinking along these lines at that particular time, and thinking, gee, and then going to see it at the neighborhood houses again. But skipping Dracula, and mostly finding out what time Frankenstein goes on, and going to see it.
I'm going to get pelted by the ghost of Forry Ackerman for saying this, but the more I studied these films, the more I became convinced that Todd Browning wasn't that much of a director.
Yeah.
Whereas the more of James Whale's films you
That's
see,
right.
you think this guy was terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
But Browning, not so much. And
No, I would have to agree with you on that, and I'm sure there will be many.
Yes, they'll come down hard on me for that.
Yeah.
When I published my book Lost Films, I would do a lot of radio interviews, and I would always, the first thing before we went on air, I would put down a $5 bill, and I would say to the guy interviewing me, this is yours if nobody calls and asks about London After Midnight. And I never had to give up that $5, but I've always thought, really, who wants to see that movie? I just can't understand it, because I've seen the Mark of the Vampire.
Yes.
Which is basically a remake, and
that's
it's awful.
Right.
It's
yeah.
just awful. So, oh well. That's this has been brought to you by the anti Todd Browning, the pro James Whale group.
Yeah.
Now, was there nothing like in New York? Museum of Modern Art was playing revival or playing older stuff from.
That's right. Yeah.
From the beginning, I mean, really,
from the beginning,
30s and 40s.
That's right, yeah.
But there was no place like that in San Francisco.
Yes, there was. And I'm glad you brought that up. There were various places. There was the what's the name of it? It was in Lincoln Park, the Palace of Fine Arts, which fortunately, living in the Richmond district, was only a few blocks away, and they had a little theater there, and on Saturday matinee, they ran old movies from the Museum of Modern Art, because, as you know, the museum had this circulating system. It was 16-millimeter prints,
mm-hmm.
which, if you were, you know, an organization of some kind, or an auditorium, or a student thing, or what have you could rent films. So I remember going there on several Saturdays to see silent movies, and this once again was, you know, in early, maybe late through early 40s in there. And also down at a place called the Jewish Community Center, which they had a big, huge auditorium for everybody, not just for the faith. And they had, I remember seeing Intolerance there one night. And again, I was probably, you know, 12, 13, been there somewhere. And thinking, gee, this is incredible. Because here was this, you know, the whole movie. And with the, I guess they think they had some kind of a pianist or an organ or whatever, I don't recall what, but they had music going with it. So I was very excited by that, and I saw the Douglas Fairbanks Robin Hood, which of course I didn't know anything about, up at the Palace of Fine Arts. And I saw, you know, kind of an eclectic thing of here, there, and the other place. And they also had, they had another theater, I'm trying to remember what the name of it was, where they showed silent movies. Now, not all the time, but on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, because I knew nothing about silent movies, and I'd never really seen one, because by the time I started, even at my young age, we were, you know, in 1932, and there weren't silent movies around, not being shown at a big theater. So I did get a chance to see those things, and then the Treasure Island, the 1939-1940 World's Fair, they were showing a Charlie Chaplin festival, I remember seeing. And that was fascinating, because, you know, I'd seen Modern Times, probably, and maybe by then The Great Dictator. But, you know, I'd never seen any of these one- and two-reelers. And, of course, it would, you know, I was fascinated, absolutely fascinated. So I was getting exposed bit by bit to the heritage number, you know, and not, you know, not by the gross, but certainly enough to whet my appetite to find out more, and I was reading more about this stuff. In fact, when I went into the Naval Air Corps in 1944, graduated from high school at 17, and not knowing, you know, I started out in Jacksonville, Florida. I'd never been out of the state, and suddenly I'm shipped to Jacksonville, Florida. I brought three books. No, I think I got one of them as I was in the service. But anyway, A Pictorial History of the Movies, mm-hmm. The Rise of the American Film, and Hollywood, The Movie Colony, The Movie Makers. Now, those were all relatively contemporary books, you know. And they all dealt, obviously, with the evolution of the movies and the studio system and the what have you. So I'm taking those thinking, well, if I get stuck somewhere on a desert, you know, and it's not like bringing novels where you think, okay, I read that novel. I can always dip into one of these books. So here I am, three hardcover books. For 2 years, I'm schlepping them around for different bases and what have you. And it was great. It was a wonderful thing to be able to say, okay, before I go to sleep, you know, I'll read for 30 minutes in The Rise of the American Film. And I must say, Louis Jacobs,
mm-hmm.
I think he did it, you know, considering that thing came out 39 or 40 sure. somewhere. I think he did an incredible job. Anyway, so that was good. And then I remember when I was stationed down at Corpus Christi, Texas, and we were there for a long time because the war was drawing to a close, and you know things weren't moving as rapidly as they had been. So you were down there at the air station. Anyway, they had a library there, and they had Fortune magazines going back to the 30s. And I discovered these issues with the motion picture studios in depth. Warner Brothers, big article on Warner Brothers and pictures of everybody in the studio system and so forth. And, of course, from the business perspective, Fortune mm-hmm. magazine. And then there was the one on MGM, and then there was Paramount. Well, I found out as time went by later, I actually got those magazines in used bookstores. They did a whole thing. They did a thing on Technicolor. This was in the early, mid, and late 30s. So I got all of those, and it was a great insight into not the aesthetics or the craft as much as the business, but and photograph and talking about, you know, the producers and talking about how that system worked at that time, which of course is completely different from what it is now. So that was a great insight. It really was, and it gave me even more interest in the business. And in addition to the other things.
Did you already start thinking about being a filmmaker at that point?
Yeah, I was thinking it would be great to be a director or in production and so forth. I wasn't thinking of writing, and I wasn't really thinking of acting. I mean, I acted a little bit in school plays and all that, but I just thought the making, because I had been making my little movies, you know, up until I went into the service, actually. And then when I got out, anyway, I just thought it was very interesting. So when I got out, I was, and of course we had the GI Bill of Rights, you know, because you know in the 30s when you were a kid, the prospect of college, which was a very elitist thing at that time, You know, I mean, it wasn't like something you think, oh, well, naturally I'm going to go to college after high school. You had to be really wealthy. I was not from a wealthy family at all. I don't mean they were, you know, they were having trouble finding get the milk. But, you know, it was a middle class, which was fine. But anyway, so I suddenly got out and I'm thinking, gee, I can go to college. And I went to the Pasadena Playhouse, which at that time had a college and had and accredited fully. You know, you could get your master's degree there. You couldn't get a bachelor's, but if you'd had to, you could get a master's degree. So anyway, and they had thesis programs, and they had playwriting majors, they had directing majors, they had acting majors, they had craft majors. Now, this was in 46, 47, 48, 49, and they were jammed, like every college was at the time. So I got to go there and do that, and then television came in. And they had closed-circuit television at the Pasadena Playhouse, where you would do a show, but it wasn't going on the air, but it was down in a monitor you could look at down in a room. They'd say, at 1:30 we're going to be doing, blah, blah, or 6 o'clock, tonight, whatever. And so this, to me, I thought, and we had equipment before KTTV went on the air, and we had the technicians, and it was almost like a warm-up period for them, because they were waiting for whatever it is you had to get on the air. And so I thought, geez, and I was a stage manager. Then I got to direct a couple of things. And again, we're talking about relatively small-scale stuff, but
this is the very birth of the TV industry,
that's
really.
That's right, and it hadn't... I remember the station started going on the air in 1948. This would have been 47 and early 48 when I was doing this at the Playhouse. And I just thought, this is the answer. And sure enough, you know, I did finish the play. I went to LA City College because I wanted to take another year of college stuff that was non-related to the business so I could, you know, take things like economics and sociology and philosophy and all that. So I went for another year. Then I went to work at Channel 13 in 1950. For $1.98 a week, and you know, and stage managed, and then became a director in 1952.
Well, of course, $1.98 was $1.98 in those days.
That's right. Yeah. And then you know, started doing network things in 1956. Anyway, but so television to me was the savior, because to try to get into the motion picture industry in the late 40s, early 50s, particularly, you know, when things were changing dramatically in the business. You know, you had to be somebody's son or, you know, whatever. So I just thought, gee, television is the answer. And it, indeed, for me, it was.
Now, while you were working in TV, you were starting to get interested in writing about film history, right? I mean, when did that start happening?
That happened, it happened officially. I became an executive producer at 13 when I went back there after I left and went to do network shows and what have you, but we'll skip over that. So I went back, was asked to go back as executive producer. We'd moved over to La Brea. We had these big stages. I did a special called Movies Golden Age, which was an hour, and it was excerpts from silent films, going back to those. And this was in 61. This is even before David Walt, not that he wasn't waiting, doing his things, but
sure.
He hadn't come out with his stuff yet that had to do with the movies, you know, the old movies, which, of course, were terrific. And I had to get special permission from the studios, and because we were running syndicated stuff from MGM on Channel 13, I wanted to get the chariot race from the original Ben-Hur, which, of course, they said, sorry, we can't do that, because the 59 Ben-Hur was, you know, still around, and they didn't want to have... But I could get the naval battle. And I wanted to use a scene from the 1922 Scaramouche with Raymond Navarro and Louis Stone with the duel, because I thought that would be interesting, you know, to see that. And I was able to get Raymond Navarro, who I didn't know at all, to come down and be a guest. And Art Baker was the host, the master of ceremonies, on camera. Anyway, to cut to the chase, as you're probably thinking, yes, Rudy, let's cut to the chase.
No, I want more preamble to chase.
I did that. I produced it and wrote it and directed it. Blah, blah. Anyway, and got the permission to get this footage, and I had to cut. MGM insisted, the legal guy, insisted that I can't use, like, and you have to cut away from, you can't, anyway, fortunately, I had editing equipment, and I got two prints of each, not the whole movie, but the sequence that I was talking about, from MGM. So I'm cutting, and then I had to show what I had to the legal guy. And he said, hey, you did it. You know, and some of it was kind of ridiculous, but we won't go into that. But the main thing is I was able to use pretty much the substance of those two sequences. And, of course, Raymond could talk about both of them, because there he was. And then we added music. There was a guy at the station who was scoring travelogues. We did a lot of travelogues. I Search for Adventure, The Golden Voyage, A Passport to Travel, etc. Because they don't cost much, and they were very popular shows. Jack Douglas, Bill Burritt, etc. Anyway, so the guy who would score a lot of that stuff, who was a staff guy, was scoring these scenes, and I'd record Art Beggar talking voiceover, and then we'd have the interview thing shot and put the thing. And of course, we were on tape, and it was early tape. This is 1961. I would schedule a editing session for all day Saturday or Sunday, whatever. Because, and this was like for six splices. Six splices for the different parts of the show. Because of the interview stuff, we'd do it one time, and you know, the voice, but anyway, the clips. Well, we were there from 8 o'clock in the morning, and of course you had a kind of like a microscope thing so you could see on the thing to make the physical splice, and then you put it up, and if there would be a roll, which would happen quite frequently, you'd have to go back and do it. Anyway, when you think of that combined with the way things now, so it was all day, long day, to make these, and it was no fancy, you know, we're not doing, we're just making a cut. In addition to Raymond Novero, I was very fortunate to meet John Hampton. I had known him, of course, because of the theater, the silent movie theater on Fairfax that he and his wife started in 1942. Wow. And, you know, he ran the project. He did all that, which we talked about. But he also was a person you'd go to if you wanted to lease some films to show on television. And, of course, when I went to him, I had met him before, but I went to him in an official capacity this time. And I said, now what I'm doing, and so forth and so forth. And I named some titles, and he said, no, we can't use that, because, of course, they were copyright, so forth. Mm-hmm. But he did come up with possibilities, and I would look at the film. This would be during the day when they were closed down. And he came up with some great ideas, like Romola, with Ronald Coleman, you know, sure. and you had all these heavy hitters, William Powell, Lillian Gish, shot in Italy, and so forth, where I could use that, you know, and Tarzan of the Apes, the first Tarzan film with Elmo Lincoln, and things of that nature. So it was really something to be able to use certain things that, you know, that still had name, and an early Douglas Fairbanks film. So it wasn't, you know, the Black Pirate or Robin Hood or the Three Musketeers or Zorro, but it was him doing his acrobatic bit all over the place from circa 1918.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was great to include that. And so many other things that he came up with, which were then augmented by, you know, the Ben-Hur and the Scaramouche and the King of Kings, which I had mentioned, which we were running, and so forth. But that was a great experience, and John Hampton would make up the print for me. And then I would edit, not of the whole movie, but the scenes that I would request based upon screening at the theater. And that theater, and it had gone on forever.
Yeah. It was always a fun place to go. Now, Hampton's collection was mostly 16mm, right?
Yes, it was, to my knowledge, it was all 16mm. He had 16mm projectors, he had the equipment, and he, you know... So that was what he did, and he played the records, as we talked about.
Yeah.
And, of course, he cleaned up the place, and his wife was picking tickets and selling candy. And that was it. I mean, it wasn't also, there were five people on the staff who, and, you know, and he, the signs were all done by him, and the collages out in front. So it was quite, and the fact that that went on so long and that he didn't tire of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, and they lived right upstairs.
What's always been amazing to me is he started it at a time when not only were there silent stars still alive, but there were silent stars still in their prime. I mean, they were,
that's right,
they were,
yeah,
still relatively young people.
Yes. Now, apparently, he had done this, it started in 42 out here, but he was from somewhere, the Midwest or wherever, where he had done this kind of thing, mm-hmm, elsewhere. So I don't know when he started it, but it wasn't new when he came out here. But this was the first time, you know, with the full theater and in the greater Los Angeles area, et cetera, et cetera. So he'd often have, you know, these stars of yesteryear and of the time coming to the theater.
Mm. Yeah, amazing. I mean, I bet you could have seen some unbelievable people.
That's
at that
right.
Time,
yeah. And some of them would come in very quiet, you know, unannounced, very quietly, and they weren't there to be on show. They wanted to see the movie.
Yeah.
That they had done back in 1921 or 2 or 3 or, yeah, 4 or 5. But anyway, it was a great experience.
Now tell me about the special, because I'm interested in the technical end of it. Did you make it as a film and then broadcast it? I mean, certainly.
No, we did it live, but we videotaped it. Now, videotape at that time, once again, we're talking about 1961, was relatively new.
Yeah.
You know, like 56, 57 it was coming in. And in terms of 2-inch, you know, broadcast quality, blah, 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 and, mm-hmm, so forth. And, of course, you didn't have anything like that before. If you wanted to record something you were doing live, you did a kinescope, which meant you photographed on film from a tube,
yeah,
the image, and now it was on film, which, of course, was something, but, you know, the quality left something to,
sure,
be desired. But anyway, this was shot on the stage, the interview and the host, you know, doing his thing. And then we transferred the film clips, and then music was added, which was done, you know, from recordings and so forth. And once again, we had to be very careful because there were certain things you could use on locally, but if you had it on other stations, or it was syndicated, or it was national, or what have you, you couldn't use that. For example, we could use recordings locally. You could use Miklos Rocha's Ivanhoe. I remember we did that for I Search for Adventure and so forth and so on, but if you syndicated it, you couldn't do that. So in this case, we had three stations that were owned at the time in different areas, and I wanted to use the robe for the Way of the Cross and the crucifixion scene from The King of Kings, which, mm-hmm, is fairly obvious. And, of course, it was a great piece of music, and Alfred Newman and what,
sure,
have you, and it was recorded, you know, on a 78 and LP. Anyway, I think the robe was only on LP. I think by then, yeah, 1953, that was it. Anyway, so we did that, but for the other stations, it had to be something that was, you know, library music, which there was a lot of, fortunately, at that time, Chappelle and,
yeah,
those companies. So in this case, it was so good. We thought, hey, for the greater Los Angeles area, let's use Alfred Newman's. And that worked fine. That's the only one that we did that with. The other we used, you know, for this market and the other two markets, we used the recordings that we picked. But they weren't, you couldn't use Miklos Rocha, obviously. But it was great locally.
Sure.
You know, with those Jack Douglas shows, The Golden Voyage, and I Search for Adventure, and so forth. You could use all that. Can you believe? And it was wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have copies of any of those?
I have a I'll make this brief, but at that time, even though I was working at the station, you couldn't just say, could I get a copy? First of all, if you had a 2-inch copy, what would you do with it? You know, you couldn't play it anywhere other than at the station. But what I wanted to do was to get a film transfer of the show. But they couldn't do that there. It was very expensive. But later on, not too much later on, I got the opening, I got the opening remarks, and I got the interview with Navarro, which was live, with Art Baker, who was the host of the show. And then I got the concluding remarks by Art Baker and the closing credits. So I do have that, but to do the hour show, it wasn't practical at that time. Now, for the O. Henry ending. So about 6 months later, I thought, okay, now I'm going to, you know, get a transfer. It was, had been erased and used for something else. They were doing that all the time then. This was not unusual. Because, okay, it's had its run, and we need the tape. And we're not saving, you know, which is what they used to do with some films, right? So anyway, I went back, and it was gone with the wind. But at least I have that.
Sure.
In fact, there was a little bit of it used when they did the Ben-Hur documentary, Turner. And this was the one that was done a long time ago, about an hour, a very long one, and it had all kinds of stuff about the early Ben-Hur and then the later Ben-Hur and interviews and what have you. And they still use it whenever they come out with another DVD, even though it was done in the 90s, maybe, yeah. And I was working with the man who was producing it, and I told him I had this. So he said, oh, so we did transfer what I had, and that's part of that interview is in that documentary. So there was a fellow, I was a big Films and Review man at the time, I mean subscriber.
Sure.
Because when that magazine started in the early 50s, and I happened to stumble onto it at somebody's, you know, coffee table, I thought, gee. Because at that time, you know, this was pretty good. Anyway, I wrote to Henry Hart, who was the editor, founding, I don't know about the founding editor, but he was the editor of the magazine. And I mentioned about this show. You know, and I said, in case somebody would like somebody to review it, I was trying to cover various bases, you know. And so I get a call from a guy that you would know, Gene Ringgold.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hi, I didn't know him. Henry Hart talked to me and said that, you know, I said, well, I can arrange a screening, you know, the tape. So he comes over in the screening area, and I'm running the thing. And the next thing I know, I get this letter from Henry Hart. I think it was a letter. It certainly wasn't a fax or an email saying, you know, Gene Ringel was telling me about how you put this thing together and, you know, the thing. Would you like to write an article on the making of this show and what you had to deal with and how you were? And I thought, yeah. I didn't have to ponder it. I thought, yeah. So I wrote an article, Movies Golden Age on TV or whatever the hell it was, which came out, I guess, at the end of 61 or sometime in there. And it was the story behind this thing. And I kind of, after I finished it, I thought, you know, I kind of like that. And I asked him if I could do something, and I can't remember. Anyway, not long after that, I thought, you know, David O. Selznick, you know, they're always writing about directors, which is fine, and writer. But, you know, here's this producer who, you know, who's gotten a lot of coverage, but I'd like to, anyway. So then I did this thing on Selznick, and Selznick was out of the country at the time, but his secretary, and it turned out where somebody says, where did he get all this? Well, I was going in the academy and various places and digging out things that had already been used in articles, and this and that, but it sounded like they were from his vaults,
sure,
which they weren't, because I couldn't get into it. You say, where did this fellow get all this? I found out later. I saw the memos, but it wasn't when I was doing the memo for. It wasn't until later when Danny Selznick said, "I've kind of held these out, but here," because he was upset, and he was writing to, you know, he was in Europe. He's saying, "Where did this fellow get all this stuff?" What did I? So anyway, he wanted to wait until he came back, and he was at the Waldorf Towers in New York, and he agreed to see me. I couldn't get back there then because of the job I was on. So Henry Hart went to see him, and then about 3 weeks later, I found out that I was going to go back on business to New York, which I was. So I said to Henry, "I can, you know." Anyway, Henry probably said, "See the kid, you know." He spent a lot of time researching this and so forth. So I made an appointment, and I went back to New York, stayed across the street. I didn't stay at the Waldorf Tower. But anyway, I went to see him one night at the Waldorf Tower, And he had somebody there who was, I guess, recording the thing, or not recording it, but at least doing a transcript of it. And I spent about 2.5 hours there, and he was answering my questions, which his recall. And we're going back, once again, to the silent days.
Sure.
His father, Louis J. Selznick, and to, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and things that he thought were wrong in what I had written in this early draft before. And he was saying, let me explain. Well, of course, Nirvana would be the word, perhaps, to describe. And I'm just sitting there with probably my jaw dropping. And, of course, I didn't say much during the course of the evening. And he was walking up and down and, you know, smoking his cigarette. And like he used to dictate his memos, presumably, you know, because they were soliloquies to a large degree, with an occasional, Mr. that ended, and I went back to my hotel, and the next morning, there's a knock on the door early, and somebody is delivering the typescript of what we had discussed last night.
Wow.
He didn't take any chances. You know, I don't want to be misquoted, because I just sat there, you know.
Sure.
He didn't want me recording this. He wanted, anyway. So, fortunately, when, you know, between Henry Hart and myself and the early stuff that I had done, the article comes out. It's by Rudy Belmer and Henry Hart, which is fine. I mean, Henry, you know, certainly contributed to the thing. And Selznick apparently was pleased. More than you wanted to know, but all of that kind of got me into primary source material,
mm-hmm.
and thinking, gee. And then a few years later, you know, thinking a book on Selznick's, when I found out the stuff was downtown at that time at the Beacons, and Danny Selznick took me down there. I had met him anyway. That's another story.
It was just in storage?
It was in storage at Beacons, because they were waiting to get it put somewhere. The Academy or USC, or, you know, it ended up down at Texas,
mm-hmm.
because Texas paid more money.
Yeah, so University of Texas in Austin.
That's right. Exactly right. Very good. A+ for you.
Well, thank you.
And this is before it went, and when it was sitting there, and of course the Selznick family was paying for it to be there. So they were trying to, even Brigham Young bid on it. They were bids, but I guess the University of Texas at Austin bid more. So they got it, but this is before then. So anyway, after I'd met Danny and talked to him a few times and had lunch with him, etc., we went down there one Saturday. Of course, I had no idea, and here's all this stuff, and, you know, in boxes. You go up in a freight elevator. And to cut to the chase once again, he said, if you want to look over something. So I took home a few boxes, which was okay with him. And I thought, just to taste the water. So it was the Stars. I was going to start with Gone with the Wind, certainly. Stars Born, The Prisoner of Zenda, and one other film. It doesn't matter. But they were, you know, good films, but not something that you... And, of course, I called him Sunday night. I'd spent the weekend. I said, I don't know how... Because I was working full-time. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. So I spent the next 2.5 years, and of course, fortunately, I could drive down and go into the place and go up and bring boxes back and then take boxes out and put them in the car. And the stuff that I thought was potential, I would Xerox, which was okay. It wasn't like mm-hmm. I was doing something I shouldn't be doing. And I was just working on it whenever I could. I'd get up at 5 a.m, you know, and before going to work and all that, spend 2 hours or 2.5 on weekends, and every time I had to take a flight somewhere, I would bring this stuff. And anyway, and spent my vacations doing it and going down there. So that was how that happened. But that, I was always fascinated with primary source material. I mean, I became fascinated
mm-hmm.
because I thought, gee, this is what was happening at the time it was happening. You know, yes, it's filtered through one office memo or one, but, you know, it was not 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, somebody said, as I recall. And there's nothing the matter with interviews. certainly we're doing one, sure. Right? But, you know, it's that, how accurate, and it's through your filtered eyes from, and sure. voice many years later. And, of course, as we all do, I'm sure we make mistakes.
Sure.
And
well, our points of view change on
our
things.
Our points of view change, and our recall blends certain things or eliminates certain things that perhaps wouldn't be as helpful. Anyway, but so I thought, gee, these things are happening, and they're written about that night or that day, and they're sending things back and forth. Anyway, so that got me onto that, which, of course, led me to Inside Warner Brothers, which... because that happened to be my favorite studio. And growing up, I loved the Warner Brothers film, and continue to, you mm-hmm. know. But so to find not just Jack L. Warner or Hal Wallace, but everybody's number. Mm-hmm. And so that made me happy, because primary source material, yay.
I tell you, whenever I get a chance to work on something that involves Warner Brothers... that's the greatest archive on this earth to go to.
I agree with you, Mark.
I love that place. I could live there. Yeah. If they would give me a cot, I would just stay there.
I'd ask for a bed.
Well, I'm not as picky as you. Clearly.
You know, I started going to the Academy Library when it was over on Melrose near Doheny around 1958-ish. And it was upstairs over the theater, the Academy Theater at that time, and it was one room. And, you know, if there were two people in there, two visitors, it was quite a thing. And they had all of their file cabinets right there in the same room and everything. And, of course, it was a gold mine. You know, suddenly I'm thinking, the Academy Library, and I'm, you know, when I could get over there. And then, of course, for many years I was going there to research articles and books and what have you, and they moved to Wilshire in the big building, and then they moved down to La Cienega, where they've been now, I guess, for several 15 years or whatever it's been. Anyway, it is such a great resource, and with all of the things that they have in the special collections, you know, these papers that were given by various and sundry luminaries, either in front of the camera or behind. And, you know, the research that you can do there in so many fields, and the oral histories, and et cetera, et cetera. And so from my standpoint, you know, it's talk about a hardy perennial that there it is. And the first, I remember when I first went to it was Betty Franklin was the librarian, and she was the one who followed Margaret Herrick.
Ah.
Who was, sure. You know, anyway. That's
who was the one?
Who was the one?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever written a book on film that without that being my major resource.
Oh, yeah.
And also, the people there are so incredibly helpful. I still miss Sam Gill, who's now up in Niles.
I know.
But that guy was an encyclopedia.
I know.
Especially I know. Early cinema.
Yes.
And I seem to remember... pretty young girl named Stacy Enders, who was always very helpful to me. I have no idea whatever became of her.
Oh, you know, it's a funny story.
Yeah?
I remember her, too, and somehow or another we got married.
You probably remember her from the story. Yes.
Yes. We got married 24 or 5 years ago. Anyway.
What's so great about the Academy is the staff is always so great and knowledgeable, because in many cases, and just the last project I was there on, I was doing some work on, you'll be shocked to learn, Beaugest.
Oh, Beaugest.
Yeah.
Moment,
that's
right?
Kind of an interesting, a new interest for me.
Yes.
But Stacy was, you know, when she saw me, she said, oh, I know there are some pictures that I bet you've never seen. And she took me over and showed me some stuff. And that's the kind of thing that
when
you go in and they know what you're looking for and they know where the things are. When I was writing a book on the great Christmas movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm lying.
But not just that Christmas in July. That wouldn't be.
Stacy's turned me toward a whole bunch of movie star Christmas photos that I used in that book.
Yeah.
And there's a whole, that was a treasure trove of stuff.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking about my book Lost Films, because the trouble with that one, of course, is that you can't see any of the films, hence the name.
Yes.
And Sam Gill
just out of the blue one day said, you know, there was some guy back in the 20s who was an organist, and he would go see movies, and he would write detailed descriptions of the movies in order to help him write his, compile his scores.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, we have all that stuff. And I never would have known about it. I never would have known to look for it.
Yeah,
but there were really detailed. He would sit in there and write down everything that happened in the movie.
Yeah.
And it was just a treasure.
And particularly something that you hadn't been aware of before.
Yeah.
You know, those are always the ones that you think, oh.
Yeah. And so that's the thing about the Academy.
Yeah.
And the other ones, as wonderful as they all are, you usually tell them what you want to see. They have it ready for you. You go in and you do your research.
Well, but now, Ned, Academy, Ned there's Comstock, something else. I have to say Ned Comstock at the USC Cinema Library. He's another one of those guys who comes up with things. I mean, it's not that you don't just come in and ask for certain things, but you say, you know, I found this. And he's still the way he was 40 years ago. Mm. You know, it hasn't, it's not like, he's jaded or something. You know, nothing like that. It's still, that's
before the Warner stuff went to the Warner Archive. I had been doing some stuff, and I went back to the University of Wisconsin at
Madison.
Gee, you're good.
Frank. I sure am.
I should remind
you on the spot. Yeah.
I'll remind you more often. Anyway, and they had the Warner UA, United Artists, because at that time, which would have been in the 60s, I guess, or 70s, yeah, 70s, I was working on another project anyway, and there were some Warner films. So they had a lot of stuff, but nothing like.
No.
I mean, they had scripts, and they had legal things.
Mm-hmm.
And they had photographs by the gross.
Which, and the films themselves.
And the film, yeah, you could run a 16 millimeter on a flatbed, which I did. I ran a lot of stuff that I...
Oh, me too.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I went back there a lot, and several times over a couple of years. Anyway, then dissolve, and now I meet through a friend of mine, a fellow at, I know his name as well as I know my own. Anyway, I'll think of it after the fact. and who was a story editor over there from 1933 at Warner's and was still there. And so I called him and I said, John Stevens had mentioned blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah, Rudy, yeah, he told me. So I went over there and I met him and he said, yeah, we've got, under the carpenter shop, we've got a lot of scripts and we've got things. And I said, oh, gee, great. Because at the time I was including about three Warner Brothers films, Maltese Falcon, Casablanca, Robin Hood, in this other book, America's Favorite Movies. Anyway, so he goes over, takes me downstairs to the carpenter shop underneath, and he's got these boxes, and up comes the Casablanca, one box of many. And I open it up, and at the top, in a wad, are these copies of memos. I said, what? He said, oh, I've been saving this stuff since 1933, gathering it all. I said, you mean on every... Yeah. And it's all... Yeah. So the... And of course this... And he said, if you want to use... We've got this empty office right down the hall from... If you want to come over when you can and go through... So I'm going through with these three films, the Casablancas and the Robin Hoods and the Maltese Falcon. And that was, you know, once again, Nirvana Revisited, only with regard... Now, he didn't have everything, because he had stuff that went, like, story stuff, and he had various things, but I don't think he had the legal things, because they would have been in the legal department. But it was stuff that he... And he'd go around and gather stuff. It wasn't like it was just through his area there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway... But it was great, and this was before then. I remember having lunch with him maybe 6 months later, and he said, I've got some news for you. Scriptorium is picking this all this stuff up, plus the League of Five. Warner Brothers is giving this material to the University of Southern California, and they're going to have a Warner Archive. Now, he wasn't happy, I think, because he was worried that something was going to happen that wouldn't be good. As it turned out, it was good. And I said, well, gee, Carl Stuckey So, you know, it, you know, sometimes it takes a while.
It comes back.
Carl Stuckey was the man's name, and a very nice gentleman. He lived right next to the studio with his wife and children. Anyway, so there we were, and he was, you know, thinking, I hope this works out. So the day that the Warner Archive opened at USC, I was waiting outside the door of the Doheny Library, which, of course, at that time, they would bring things over to you at the library, the cinema library.
Sure.
And that's where I met Leith Adams. There was somebody that preceded him, but then Leith came in, and Leith, I was continually asking for more and more stuff, and coming down there on Saturdays, which of course was great, because I was off on Saturdays, and then whenever I had a chance and vacations, and I just spent going through everything, and Ned Comstock, you know, these guys were just unbelievable.
They're the best of the best.
Yeah. And here's the Jack Warner collection, which Ned, you know, so that was an augmentation. And, you know, you just kind of think, how did this ever happen? You know, how could it luck out like this? And then I remember, to cut to the chase once again, making a presentation to the then head of the legal department at Warner Brothers, who fortunately, he was an older man, he was getting ready to retire in a couple of years, and he was familiar with the Selznick memo book. And I was saying, I'd like to do something like this on Warner Brothers, but using, you know, not just Jack Warner, but everybody. And he got back to me and said, okay. Now, they weren't going to pay me anything, but I got a letter of agreement that this would be a project I could do, and that I would have, you know, the ability to solicit and that the copyright would remain with Warner Brothers, which, of course, I knew. I mean, it wasn't something, oh, really? You mean I can't? You know, and I knew what the story was, and, of course, I was employed. You know, so it wasn't like I was employed, you know, by an advertising agency producing stuff anyway. So I thought, gee, this is great. They approved it. And I got a line lawyer over there who was going to actually look through things when I got them ready. And that's how that worked. More than you wanted to know, right?
Not even nearly as much as
you
I want to know.
I think, Rudy, yes. Remember less is more.
Yes,
yeah, Rudy. It's better to be brief than tedious.
Could
Rudy.
You could you talk about something more interesting? That's what I want to know. it just seems to me that you were either part of a sea change or you were the sea change. Because film scholarship before then had been not very meticulous. You read A Million and One Nights or any of these histories, they are valuable in their way, but they aren't very specific about things. And there came along you, Kevin Brownlow.
Well, Kevin preceded me, certainly. He was interviewing people, and also getting primary source material when he could. So, I mean, he preceded me by a certain time. But in terms of the Hollywood studios, I think at least I was able to get in there at a time when it was...
Yeah.
And, of course, timing, once again. You know, I mean, the Selznick thing, you couldn't just walk in those days and look at that stuff. And with the Warner Brothers thing, once again, I was there when they opened it up, and I was at the studio before that. So, you know, you have to also take into effect timing, right?
But it was a matter of asking these people real questions. Because I encountered it a lot. Now, I started interviewing people in the late 70s, so had a lot fewer people to deal with. But even then, they were sometimes shocked when you didn't want to settle for their regular story about something.
Right.
Because they kept telling the same story about things.
Right.
And when I first started working on the Wellman book, I realized how many things that he had just fashioned into a good anecdote, which didn't hold any water at all once you really started going to the primary documents and seeing what actually happened.
That's right.
And so...
And even, you know, like the Raoul Walsh book, I'm speaking of the one that he did several years ago. You know, when you when you know more about the whole situation, the things he didn't say or the things he left out or the things that he said that were, you know, fabrications. But sure. He probably thought, hey, it's a good story.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I think it's the case with almost all of those guys. Yeah. I mean, the Capra book, too. Almost.
Yeah, just that's right.
So much half-truth in that book,
yes.
Or non-truth.
But, and, of course, the fact that the Capra book happened to be so successful.
Yeah.
Like in 70, 71, around in there.
Yeah, it seemed like it was a little later than that. But
no,
it
wasn't, because the Selznick book came out in 72, and I remember they were thinking, hey, you know, which it wasn't. It was not going to repeat. But it was the Capra book was a good success, not just with film buffs, but fortunately his name, the name above the title, meant something, I guess, because people were still... But that book was a kind of a fluke. It was, you know, for movie history to be, you know, kind of general readership,
yeah.
In a sense. And I think that that started it. But I think, you know, once again, he thought these are good stories. Or, you never know, maybe that's the way he thought about it. You know,
I think all those guys thought that the real truth was just a little too... I don't think they were trying to cover anything up, necessarily. I think they just wanted to take the raw material and turn it into a better yarn.
Yeah, that's
all.
Probably true.
And give it a good beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Because when you...
Or not necessarily a good...
Yeah. or at least a dramatic one.
Yeah, right.
Because that's what I always notice when I read Wellman's two books, the one that was never published, Growing Old Disgracefully, and the first one, is that he can't help but wrap something up in a way that's like a story.
No,
not like
right.
Real life.
That's right.
Because I have a million stories I could tell you where...
A million and one.
It just... A million and one nights it would take me to tell you. And they just peter out toward the end because don't really... I mean, they have an interesting startup, but they don't really go anywhere.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But if I were writing it down, I'd think, well, I really need to wrap this up in some way. So
I've got an idea. I agree with you. And it's... And the more you discover, you know, as time, the more you realize how important primary source material is.
Yeah.
I remember going over to the AFI when they had all these oral histories, and they still do, of course, but, you know, they were relatively new at the time. And, you know, you think, oh, here's Henry Blankey who produced the... And I had met Henry back in 61, and he was wonderful and he was great. But he, unfortunately, by the time he got to do the AFI thing, and by the time I called him about the films of Errol Flynn, and it's not his fault, he was getting Alzheimer's, and it's unfortunate, but that happens. But that oral history, which could have been, if it had been done 5 years earlier, would have been terrific, because when I saw him for lunch, I was asking him all kinds of questions, because there was no... I couldn't get to the Warner files there. And he was answering things on the Robin Hood film, because I was doing an article on Robin Hood on the Screen. And he said, no, here's the way it worked. And he was right. I mean, later on, when I got into the files, I was asking about, well, how come William Keeley and Mike, how did they... Well, let me tell you how... And he was absolutely on. But, of course, who knew? You know, what was I going to check it against? But anyway, here you had these oral histories, and some of them which are very good. And once again, the timing was right. The people were, you know, and you get these Hugo Friedhofer's oral history. Yeah, it's absolutely spectacular.
Mm.
Well, to me.
Sure.
You know, and his way of describing things in his detail. And of course, it wasn't always that he was trying to make himself out as the hero of this. You know, he was giving... And there's several others. I don't just mean him. But and then, you know, you had the ones that didn't come off. But then that's the story of our lives, right?
Well, sure.
But I thought that, what a great thing. I can look at these oral history. But then you realize that oral history, which is it's a good thing to have, but you can't rely on them, particularly when they aren't annotated and edited. You know, he'll say something, and it's not like the asterisk. Actually, this is not the... And I'm a great believer in let's do the actually what happened was.
Yeah.
As far as you know. I mean, you can't, you know, it's not 100%. But when it's 100% off, I think it should be annotated. But I could be wrong.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Rudy Belmer. There'll be another one coming up in the near future. Not quite decided yet whether it's going to be next week or whether it's going to be in a few weeks. But check your local listings, won't you? I want to give a shout-out to three great collaborators on this podcast. No, make that four. I'll add a fourth, even more valuable one. First, our music theme is by Gary Rand and Rob Clearfield, two Chicago boys. I've known Gary since we were pups. Rob, I've only known a shorter amount of time, but have been very impressed with his composing skills and his skills at the piano. In fact, he's writing the music for my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, which is in the final stages of production. We hope it'll be done in the next few weeks. Also want to thank my dulcet-toned announcer, my Ed McMahon, if you will, my trophy wife, Claire McCullough. And also want to give a shout-out to someone that we haven't heard a shout-out from today, Pecker the Rooster. I haven't heard a single crow from Pecker during this podcast, and that's possibly because I have moved to the other side of the house. I'm actually in the garage like Marc Maron today, except I would say a much better-tempered Marc Maron. But sitting in the garage, and it's much quieter here unless I decide to do a load of laundry, and that it'll get noisy then. But I know that many people have commented on Pecker's chiming in now and again to give his 2 cents worth on his views of film history. And we miss him this week, but maybe next week I'll be back in my office, and then I'll only be one thin wall away from Pecker's crowing. So maybe he'll be back next week. And I hope you'll be back next week, crowing or not. Whether it's Rudy or not, we're going to have a great guest because we've got some great ones lined up. I've already told you previously that we've got Kevin Brownlow, Carl Davis, John Bengtson, Randy Skretvedt, Marilyn Moss, Patricia King Hansen, Joe Musso, who worked with Alfred Hitchcock and Irwin Allen and other great filmmakers and has terrific stories to tell. And those are just the people that we've already interviewed and are ready to go. I've got some other terrific people lined up. I wish I could tell you those, but I feel a little superstitious about it until they're actually in the can, if you can call this chip that I put into my Zoom recorder a can. So keep listening. Keep going to the website. Hope you'll buy my books and videos from there. I hope you'll check out Rudy Belmer's books and videos. To find those, you just go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and click on View Full Post on the podcast page where you would listen to today's podcast. So even if you subscribe on iTunes, you can go to the website, click on the podcast for Rudy Belmer, and then hit View Full Post, and you'll see Amazon links to books and videos, and they're all not only worthwhile, but essential. He's one of the greatest, and I think you'll get a big kick out of his books if you've never read them, and also his commentary tracks, which are sometimes far more fascinating than the movies themselves, although he does some pretty darn good movies. So, there's a lot for you to do, so I won't keep you from it any longer. I appreciate your listening. I hope you'll be back with me next week. And leave a nice rating on iTunes. And if you don't have anything good to say, please don't say anything. What do I need this kind of grief for? I do and do and do for you kids, and this is the thanks I get. So we'll see you next week. And don't worry, we'll fix it in post.